Welcome to 167 Hours Beyond Sunday, a companion podcast to the sermons of Crossroads Christian Church in Gray, Tennessee, where we try to go beyond the message and talk about what life looks like in the 167 hours we're not in church a week. I'm your host, my name is Ryan Evans, and today I'm joined by one of our kids ministers, Olivia Albrecht. How are you?
I'm doing swell. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Good. Anything interesting going on in your life? Anything worth noting? Any interesting stories? Anything good going on this week?
Not that much. I'm excited about Thanksgiving with my family and with my parents, and that's about it. I'm not doing much these days.
Yeah. You know, that's, I haven't considered that, but it's kind of a mean question to ask in like a time. I was like, yeah, no, actually I can't go do anything really. Yeah.
It's a real mean, question to ask an extrovert.
Yes. You know, and you add an extra layer of throwing a baby into the mix of that, because that's the world that we live in over at the Evans household. Basically, we are in our house always, other than when I'm at work. It's pretty boring.
But Ellie is cute.
That's right. There is some form of entertainment. And she's so close to giggling, Olivia. She's so close. Like, I just make faces at her and she'll start to do it, but she's not quite there yet. I'm so dang excited.
You're going to have to capture that on video and send it to me so I can pretend that I know Ellie in real life.
We'll be able to make like a full movie based upon the amount of pictures and videos that we've already taken of her. So by the time she, you know, hits 18, she'll have a full, you know, video documentary of her entire life. So
great material for her future memoirs or documentaries or whatever she does.
Documented too much. That'll be the story. So listeners, I don't know if you were here this last Sunday or paid attention, but if you were, you would know that we have new Advent devotionals books for the church. And Olivia, you're the one who kind of came up with that idea and coordinated the effort to make it happen. So for those of you listening, you know, what are you excited about with those devotions? Why did you want to do those? And what do you think we'll get out of them?
Yeah, I wanted to pour into a new creative outlet with the rest of the staff in the midst of things being stressful and slightly mundane in the season of COVID. And it was one of the church-wide things that I've gotten to lead for the first time in a while. But these devotions are an excellent opportunity for us as a community to reflect on the wonder that God with us is. And it's a great way for us to have tangible connections with the rest of our faith family and community, which we're all wanting in this season.
And remind me, what are the four themes in the book?
Great pop question, pop quiz. Hope, peace, joy, and love. And then we have Jesus on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. I mean, I think if there were four things that we'd need in the season, hope, joy, peace, love. That'd be really good.
Agreed.
Yeah. So listeners, this last Sunday, Larry Albrecht preached and your dad. He talked about worrying, the last sermon in our November series. And before we get to it, I'm curious, so what comes to your mind when you hear the word worry?
So here's the thing. I'm the type of person who has probably caused more worry than I have felt. But the times that I worry, it's about someone or something that I care about. So I correlate worry with care or things that are important to me a lot.
Okay. All right. So like, can you give us any kind of example of that?
There are people in my life that I care about, and, you know, I worry about the decisions that they are making, or I want them to make the best decisions. And then I have to learn or understand the boundaries of like, it's not my responsibility to like oversee other people's decisions. They're allowed to make those themselves, and they don't have to be the ones that I would make. Or, you know, a great example of that, now that I'm thinking about it, is my maternal grandmother. She lived in Portland, Oregon for over 50 years. That's where she got married, and that's where she built her life. And when she sold the house that she raised my mom and their family in, we wanted her to move out to Tennessee because, you know, she was getting older, she had a lot of health issues, and her quality of life would have been better if she had moved. But she wasn't ready to move, and so she bought a she bought a new house and lived there until she couldn't take care of herself. And even, so it was the last 2 years of her life that she lived here. And that was a hard decision for her to make. And my parents had to go out and take care of a lot of things to do with her estate. And it was a lot to get her to move. And would her quality of life been better if she had moved when she was in better health? Probably. Mm-hmm. But that was not my decision to make. That was hers. And I didn't have to agree with it. And it didn't have to be on my timetable for it to be the right decision for her in the stage that she was in.
My father had a saying growing up. It drove me absolutely bonkers. He would say, there are things you can control and things you can't. And I got that phrase a lot because I can very much relate to that. It's like, you know, when there are other people who have to make decisions and you care about them, you want to make them to make, but you can't control them, right? It's like you got to let people do their things, or sometimes situations are out of your control and you just got to roll with it. But that is not fun. I very much like to be the one in control. I always joke with Megan that one of my, if I'm feeling out of control in my life and I'm, you know, anxious about things, I'll play a video game because I get to go to a world where I control everything. It's beautiful. You know, it's like, ah, yes, there's no COVID here. That's great. You know? So Larry shared three main drivers, which are really interesting, of anxiety and worry. That's kind of driving up the percentage of anxiety that people are experiencing, especially kids 13 through 18. Like, obviously, this is becoming our young adults now. Mm-hmm. And I think to a certain degree, you and I are young enough to kind of be on the, be connected to this as well. I think our generation has experienced anxiety in a different way. So I think it'll be an interesting conversation to talk about all three of them. So I'm curious to hear your perspective on each of these, and if you know if you've experienced them or not when in your youth. So the first one he shared was an unrealistic expectations or a pressure to succeed. I'm wondering if you interacted with that.
Yeah, that is the one I probably felt the most as an adolescent, and even as an adult still feel now, because I want to meet other people's expectations of me. I want to succeed. Mm-hmm. Like I grew up, you know, having good grades and school coming really naturally to me. So anytime that I struggled in a school sense, it was really hard because I had those expectations of school is supposed to come easy to me and I should succeed. And like Hebrew was a really hard language for me to learn. And that was a class that I had to work really hard to do mediocre in.
Yeah. Languages are hard. I stink at languages. I remember getting a C in Greek and celebrating.
I
think it's really interesting. I get this sense, and you work with kids, I work with students, we've interacted with the parents. There seems to be this growing, I'm trying to think of how to say this kindly, and parents hear me well, this growing fear to let kids fail,
mm-hmm.
Which is super unfortunate because we learn from failure better than we learn from anything else, including learning how to fail. So it feels like by the time a lot of kids even graduate high school, they have been protected from failure in most avenues of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get into the adult world. And failure, it's harder to protect an adult from failure. Sometimes it's just going to happen. I've mm-hmm. failed. I'm sure you've experienced failure. It's not fun.
Yeah.
And especially if you haven't had the time to deal with it before and learned how to deal with it. So I don't know. That's what I thought of when I thought of that prompt, unrealistic expectations and a pressure to succeed. I think we as a society would be doing our kids more favors by letting them fail occasionally and letting them see that that's okay. In fact, we shouldn't be afraid of failure. We should, you know, embrace it.
Yeah, I mean, I think an important thing to point out, I'm not a parent, but several of my friends are, and several of the people that mentor me and have shaped me are. And one thing I've noticed is correlating their kids' failure to their own failure as a parent.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's not true. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that tells me that parents that feel that way have a strong sense of identity in parenthood, which is beautiful and wonderful and very needed. But my failure is not my parents' failure. And it was not my parents' failure when I was a kid. And it's not the people who, are authority over me. My failure is not theirs. It's my own. And it's healthy to learn how to fail and how to fail well and with grace, and how to be able to take redirection or correction.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a good thing. I mean, I think it's a good mindset for parents to hear. And I've interacted with this as well. In fact, one time I was at men's ministry and a couple of dads made this comment, you know, like, it's easy to say that you should let your kid fail, but it is easy to take pride in your kid's success. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like, if you have a child and maybe they fail at something, that could seem embarrassing for you. And I think if you prioritize, you know, the wrong side of that, you know, trying to look good instead of what's best for the kid, yeah, that could be a potential problem. And we can both say that as you who don't have kids and me who just had my first kid, and I'm sure I'm going to mess up with that. Especially with Ellie. She's so dang cute. I just, you know, she can't do anything wrong. Surely not. Surely not.
Surely not.
So the second thing that Larry shared is that the world can feel scary or threatening. I can't imagine why that would be, you know, especially in 2020.
Yeah, there's no reason. Just kidding. Yeah, there's uncertainty is not threatening because we love control and knowing how it's going to end. I mean, that's the whole reason people love spoilers is, you know, knowing where it's going to end, or we rewatch the same things or listen to the same things when we're stressed as we know what to expect. The world is uncertain and scary and can be threatening at times.
Yeah, I think we also know too much now. Like, I really think that contributes to the problem. And hear me out when I say this, because it's like I think about when I was a kid. I didn't have a cell phone. I'm like 11-year-old, 12-year-old. I'd just leave the house on my bike. Wouldn't even tell my mom where I was going. I would disappear for the entire day. Just be gone. And then I would just appear back, and it was no big deal. Like, at the time, granted, I don't know, maybe that's a rarity for, but, you know, we've moved away from, like, freedom with kids, and because we know too much. There's too many news reports out there about serial killers. There's too many reports of kidnapped children. There's too, you know, it's like, I don't think that would even happen. I don't think we would let Ellie leave without we would microchip her, you know, so we could keep track of where she was at all times.
You and Megan are those parents.
Maybe. I don't know. We might not be that bad. But I'm saying, like, it's becoming more and more rare. And I really do think it's because there's too much. And I think kids sense that, too. I think kids hear us talking about, you know, adults talk about all the problems. And, you know, even now, like, I try not to watch the news because it's just a practice of depression at this point. Between all of the COVID reports and who's infected now and where the rates are. And it's not that that stuff's not useful information, but it's scary.
Yeah,
and it's overwhelming. And I'm an adult. I can't imagine how a 13-year-old would interact with that.
Yeah, it's scary, especially as you and I are, as adults, we know how fast years go because our memory is longer. But for kids, they have shorter memories than we are because they've lived less life. And it feels like bigger parts of their world. Being in online school or the season that we're in, it feels like a whole year to them because it has been a whole year to them. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge percentage of their life, where it's not that long of a percentage for us as adults. But even with that, anything that doesn't have an end date or a timestamp or a deadline is already anxiety inducing because we don't know how long it's going to be or when or where the end is.
Yeah. And there's a lot of life that is uncertain. I think that's we talked about that recently. I think it was Curtis. And was there another sermon series called No Fear? I think there was.
Possibly. I think it,
And I remember uncertainty being that. Actually, I think it might have been the series. I know we work here. We should know this. Sorry, listeners. We're just as bad as you all remembering the week before. So the last one he shared was social media and technology, which I think might be a large contributor to the first two as well.
Yeah.
Social media and technology certainly doesn't help in making the world feel scary or threatening because information's too easily accessible. Social media also, I mean, everyone's competing on Instagram. My life is the best. Look at it. I'm so cool. My life's the best. Look at it. I'm so cool. I'm sure that is certainly not helping with unrealistic expectations and a pressure to succeed. So I don't know, like, how do you think social media and technology are kind of affecting anxiety?
You brought up some great points. I think you're right on the mark there. You know, and a lot of these anxieties that we're talking about, while they do affect that age range that we pointed out earlier, I think adults feel it as well, because when it comes to comparing someone else's highlight that is curated and edited for consumption to our average moments, of course we feel less than. You know, doing the dishes is not glamorous. I've made lots of jokes of like, how on earth could I have to run the dishwasher every single day?
Yeah.
You know, and that is not glamorous, but that has been, you know, that's a part of my life. That's the first thing I do when I get home from work is I empty the dishwasher so I can put, you know, the night's dishes in there. And that's not exciting or glamorous. And most of what we do is mundane, you know, because that's part of, you know, daily life, and that's what we're experiencing. But what we're consuming on social media is the curated highlight points.
And I think that's important for people to, because I think if you are a person who falls into the comparison game too easily, it's worth recognizing that what you're seeing image-wise, post-wise from other people isn't average. It's curated, like you're saying. We don't post pictures and of Ellie crying after she's pooped her pants at 4 a.m. We don't do that because that's not the glamorous side of, you know, our experience with Eleanor. You know, we post the ones of her smiling and laugh, you know, and it's worth recognizing that. And really beyond even the 13 to 18 age range, all people should realize this, there is incredible statistical correlation between social media and depression.
Mm-hmm.
It is undeniable at this point. Now, there's different theories about what causes that, what's happening, whether it's comparison or whatever. There's also a lot of conversation around our lack of ability to have healthy relationships and communication when our main interactions happen through social media, because it's not the same. It's not the same as having a face-to-face conversation. It's not the same as being real and authentic. You have too many barriers on social media. There's too much distance. There's too much time. You know, it is not the same. And I could talk about that for a good while, but I'm not the guest, and we've already talked for almost 20 minutes, and I want to make sure we get to the rest of this stuff. So Larry also shared Sunday that the literal translation of the Greek word for worry is having a divided mind, specifically divided mind. So I was curious, what do you think that means for us as Bible readers, Olivia?
That's a great question. I mean, it begs us to investigate, like, what are we splitting our focus from, mm-hmm. and what should we be focused on? And I think it's a great reminder that for us as believers, we have the responsibility for our hearts and our minds to be focused on the truth that Scripture gives, but most importantly, being focused on Jesus's mission and in the way that Jesus taught us to live. And anything that separates us from that and living our lifestyle in that way is how we get a divided mind, and how we start to focus on the things that are not quite as important or not quite as fulfilling or distractions.
Yeah. So what are some ways that maybe you'd recommend that we combat worrying or combat being mentally divided?
Yeah, I'm going to go from big picture to smaller practices, but I had a couple of ideas You know, first being focus on what matters and, mm-hmm. and shape the rest of your life around that instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
I mean, following Jesus is a lifestyle. So, it's not something that we can fit in if our life isn't built around that. And if you've built your life or routines around the things that don't matter to you, of course you're going to have a divided mind. Of course you're going to be unfulfilled and full of worry. The next is knowing when to ask for help and where you can go to get help.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to trust the people in my corner to give me correction or help when I need it. I've had to learn how to ask and say, hey, I need help here. Or I need some feedback, or mm-hmm. I need to process this with someone. There's also, you know, there's goodness in going to counseling, or I go to spiritual direction. And so that is, where I meet with, someone who pastors me as a, you know, and helps me figure out where God is at in my life. Or, you know, there's goodness in taking medication that can help balance our brain chemistries, in the times that we need it. And lastly, gratitude. This is a practice that my spiritual director has assigned for me for this month, because it's easier to combat worry and to focus on what mm-hmm. matters when we're able to focus on what's in front of us. And gratitude is a really easy baby step to notice what's around us.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, in our student ministry gathering this last Wednesday, the last one of the year, we talked, you know, about giving thanks, because it just seemed like the right time. Thanksgiving's next week.
A little on the nose.
Yes. Sometimes it's the easiest thing to be on the nose. But I really, one of the things that stuck out to me about that, the verse we were focusing on, is it doesn't say be thankful. It says give thanks. And I really do believe there's a lot of power in actually vocalizing or writing or expressing thanks out loud, like being specific. I am thankful for this thing. I am, you know. And I really do think that gratitude helps us reorient our minds and focus on the stuff that matters, and realize that, because, you know, we're really good at convincing ourselves that our lives are horrible when a lot of times they're not. In the grand scheme of things, they're really not. So I'm glad that you mm-hmm. mentioned that. And I want to hit on this, because I think one unique skill set that you have specifically is pastoral care, or caring for people in hard times. You've spent several hours in the hospital, you know, alongside of people with sickness and in bad health, or with their families. So I was curious, because, you know, not, we shouldn't just as Christians care about ourselves. So mm-hmm. some of us are dealing with worrying in our lives, but what do we do when we're dealing with someone else who's mm-hmm. having anxiety or worry? So I was wondering if you could give us some advice on how to talk to or care for people who are anxious or worried.
Yeah, that's a great question. Last summer, I did an internship with the Spiritual Health Center with Ballad. So those are the chaplains in the hospital. And so I got, you know, a crash course on how to be with someone when someone they care about is actively dying. And I got to spend a lot of time in the ICU units and in the trauma units. So everything that I experienced was fast and extreme. And there were lots of raw feelings there. And something I learned is the two things that people don't need in those moments where they're anxious or worried or experiencing pain is they don't need, and they definitely don't want, pity or us making their vulnerable situation about ourselves.
Yeah.
Those are the least pastoral and least caring approaches.
So easy to do. So easy to be like, I know what you're going through. That's not a helpful phrase. And sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
And people are different. So you could, and I think this is important to realize, like, you and I are different people. We might interact with the same thing and need to process it completely differently.
Yeah.
So for me to say, well, I know what you're going, you know, that's not fair. It's not necessarily fair. Sorry to cut you off there. I just thought that was a good insight.
No, you're good. And even if you do know what someone is going through, that doesn't always provide the comfort for them that mm-hmm. that it provides for us. It makes us feel really valuable in those moments. But if you think back to Job, his friends offered their greatest comfort and were at their best amidst his pain, until they opened their mouths. They were great comforts and cared for him. And then they opened their mouths and things got off track. And so in those vulnerable moments, most people just want a listening ear or a caring friend. They don't want a hero that fixes everything or someone that points out, well, you know, that may be bad, but someone has it worse. And both those things are boundaries that I need to remind myself of, because I want to be able to fix it for the people that I care about. That's why, you know, how I experience worry is how I want to care for the people and love the people in my lives and that show them that I care. But even though I feel that way and that's my intention, that method is not a caring method because it is more about what they need or what it needs to be more about what they need than what makes me feel the most wanted or needed or helpful in a situation. Go ahead.
And I think people need to not underestimate the like when you if you don't know what to say or you don't know what to do, pretending is not help. It is okay to just say, man, this stinks. I don't even know what to say right now. I'm so sorry. And just be there. Because oftentimes that's as much as people need is just a friend that loves them enough to be there. And I'll also say this, I think you kind of said this, but there are a lot of really damaging Christian cliches out there that we could all just throw away right now. It's all going to be okay, or God has a plan. I tell you, that's one of the meanest things you can say to someone in a hard moment. And also, we don't even know what that means as Christians when we say that. Mm-hmm. Like, if we really unpack that statement, well, God, okay, so you're saying God hurt my family member?
Yeah, there's a lot of bad theology behind a lot of common cliches. I think they were meant because we don't know what to say in those moments. And we're really uncomfortable with the not knowing what to say, not being able to fix it, or the having to sit in silence or sit in that pain or vulnerability, because it is uncomfortable as all get out.
It's not fun.
But I think the two simplest approaches, to care that we can put into action in those situations you were talking about is first, you know, asking, tell me more. I mean, you said you and I can experience the same thing and have two different ways of processing it or two different experiences within that. And it is powerful and validating to ask about someone's experience and it doesn't put your words in their mouth, which is another helpful thing. And the second is, and I mentioned it earlier, of being quiet and still being present. Silence can be uncomfortable, but the thing is our comfort isn't the priority when we're caring for others.
Yeah.
And going back to Job's friends, they had such a caring presence. And they sat when they just sat with him in his pain.
Yeah. And they're a great example of this. Cause what did they do? They didn't know what was going on. So they started pretending like they did. And they said a bunch of stuff that was wrong. And, you know, they even accused Job of sin at certain points because he was going through not helpful, not helpful whatsoever.
Yeah. And I'm the queen of jumping to conclusions in situations where, you know, we don't know the whole story. Mm-hmm. And it is easy to jump to conclusions of, oh, well, you're overreacting, or that must not be that bad, or clearly you're getting what you deserve.
Yeah.
You know, and there are things out of our control and circumstances that we don't know all the details to.
It's okay to not know what to do.
Yeah.
Just be there. And so I want to say those again in short. So ask questions.
Yeah. Tell me more.
Be comfortable with silence.
Be comfortable. Yeah.
And I think I would add that third one that you kind of already said is it's not about your comfort. It's about the person you're comforting. I think that's incredibly important. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
So we're actually reaching the end here, but I do want to give you one last chance. Is there any other wisdom you'd like to share about worrying or how you deal with a worry or anything like that?
Good question. gratitude is a practice, you know, I mentioned it earlier, of helping me focus on what matters and focusing on what's in front of me. And figuring out those methods where we don't have the divided mind, but we can be focused on what matters and what Jesus has called us to do.
Yeah. According to the therapist I saw last week, I think he said, you know, one of the most asinine things that we can do is think that focusing on the problems is going to make things better. Focusing on the solutions is actually what's helpful. That has stuck with me since then. And I think that is certainly a little bit of that. So thank you, Olivia, for the conversation. And thank all of you for joining us this week. If you're on iTunes and don't mind, we'd love if you gave us a 5-star rating and maybe a review. If you want to keep up with all of what Crossroads activities are and what we're doing, find more content. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can find us by searching Crossroads Christians. There's all kinds of content for adults, kids, and teenagers for you to engage with. And make sure you grab your Advent devotional booklets. You can find those on crossroadsgray.org. You can actually have them shipped to your house.
We did. We shipped out a bunch today.
Adults and kids, so take advantage of that. But more than all of that, please make the most of the rest of your 167 hours. Have a great week.